The Man in Line, brought to you by NetZeroMatrix.com, the world's leading carbon register and validation ecosystem.
Pastor Mike, good afternoon. Welcome to Man in Line on Mike's Radio, live through until one. With the Home Affairs Minister, James Paul Wilson, MHK. For personal reasons, Dan Davis, the chief exec, won't be with us today, but Sam McCauley is his deputy, and Sam's with us through till one today. Now, any thoughts, any questions, anything you'd like to put to the team, by all means call 66 13 68, text 166 177, email studio@maxradio.com, and of course you can watch that on the same number. So first of all, Faster Mai, good afternoon, James Paul Wilson, MHK.
Faster Mai, Andy.
And Sam McCauley. Hi, Sam.
Faster Mai, Andy.
Good to hear from you. Good to be with you today. First of all, let's pile straight in. David Dawson wrote me a note and said, I'm off island on Monday, so I wonder if you could ask Mrs. Paul Wilson where the DHA is in recruiting a new chief fire officer. Last time on the show, Mr. Davis said they were reviewing the appointment, with looking to advertise the vacancy to a wider audience. And obviously we have a new chief constable. What's the situation with the chief fire officer?
Yes, so we do have an interim posting at the moment, and the planned work at the moment for the Fire and Rescue Service is to do a peer review, which we anticipate will be happening in the next few months. There's also some planned work to do, develop a community risk management plan. And that's, both of those pieces of work are to enable us to take stock and do some future planning. And then the aim would be to recruit to on a permanent basis with the benefit of that information.
Okay. Are things changing in the Fire and Rescue Service?
Well, I think we have to be mindful that, you know, compared to the situation a couple of decades ago, the nature of demand and response for the Fire and Rescue Service definitely has changed. So I think it's about understanding what our risk is, what our response should be, and how to make sure we're fit to respond to that today as well as into the future.
Okay. Is it true there that you're going to demolish the fire station on Peel Road? Is that going?
Well, we have been waiting for some condition surveys for various government buildings, and there is a challenge with that particular premises. It is, you know, in need of substantial repair. So one of the other pieces of work that you will see in our delivery plan is work on a blue light strategy, which actually is about how we can work more effectively across our emergency services. Yeah. Aligned to that, though, is looking at things like what is the right way to proceed for the future in terms of premises and replacement of premises as they are required to be replaced.
There was a mooted a few years ago, this blue light hub, where all emergency services would merge onto one site. But that was not back at the time. Has it been resurrected?
Well, that is part of the work that ties into the blue light strategy, Andy. So, you know, what we need to do first and foremost is understand what the demand is, what the need is, how to best work together collaboratively as the emergency services. But an allied piece is, then what does that mean in terms of premises and equipment and so on?
I mean, just on a personal note, the Peel Road Fire Station is iconic, and they do a terrific PR thing, I think, every week, where they obviously clean all the fire engines, put them out, almost on public view. It's almost a kind of show of public service where they reassure the public what fire and rescue do.
You're right, and I think, you know, the visibility of the Fire and Rescue Service, I think that's very powerful, isn't it? So, but it's also right that we plan for future infrastructure needs and for replacement and upgrade of facilities and equipment as we need to.
Okay, Julian's first on the line now. Hi, Julian, you're live with Sam McCauley.
Hi, Andy,
and
hi, Jane.
Paul Wilson.
Hi, Andy. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Just a quick one for you, Jane. I notice you're working on a new sentencing bill which would pave the way for future hate crime laws here. In April this year, the UK enacted the equivalent piece of legislation which they call the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act. However, before this act was passed in the UK, the former Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, Sir Peter Fahey, said this act would threaten civil liberties. And David Blunkett, the former UK Home Secretary, He called the bill an anti-protest bill threatening to make the UK look like Vladimir Putin's Russia. And various politicians and human rights groups and journalists and academics were fiercely critical of its impact on free expression, freedom of speech and right to protest. And another concern was granting the UK Home Office Minister unprecedented broad powers to make regulations without reference to Parliament and to decide the type of protest deemed acceptable by the state. My first question for you is, why do you think there has been so much criticism and concern expressed over that UK Act and if it applies to this new one?
So thanks, Julian. I think it's probably helpful at this point just to highlight the difference between what's going on in the UK and what we're thinking of in the Isle of Man. So when we talk about hate crime, actually the UK already has various pieces of legislation, as does Scotland. And I think it's important to distinguish those particular pieces of legislation, what they're aimed at, from the police crime and sentencing legislation in the UK. So our work is not about protest. It is about some looking at what the appropriate way to address problems on the Isle of Man are when we have individuals, and I can think of three cases, and I've also had the coroner of inquest write to me about a particular case where individuals have come to harm physically on the Isle of Man because of their protected characteristic, whether that's race or sexual orientation or another protected characteristic. And so that's the focus of any future hate crime policy and legislation in the Isle of Man, which is a different thing. So I hope that's helpful just to clarify that and draw that distinction.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. If you pick one of those cases, you might be referring to the one I think that happened in Peel. I think the defendant got a suspended sentence, I think. But the current law, as far as I know, is something like the Public Order Act of 98 on the Isle of Man. And that person, the Deemster, would have had the discretion to have given about 3 years in prison up to and about a £5,000 fine, but chose not to do that. So that kind of says to me that the Deemster was using his discretion. Were there any mitigating circumstances that would have lowered the sentence? Because 3 years in prison might have appeared to be way too much, but he had the power to do it. So if the power is already there, why do we need the new layer of legislation?
So I think there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I hope you'll understand that I'm not going to comment on individual cases. Obviously, you know, Tynwald, our parliament, we set the framework around sentencing and so on. But in any particular case, of course, that is a matter for the courts. And, you know, most of us, unless we're actually sitting throughout the case and hearing all of the evidence, what we find out about it in the end is what's reported in the media. So it is really, really difficult in practice to pass any comment on particular decisions in particular cases. But I think the other thing that's certainly of interest to me and certainly has been flagged by particular cases and the judiciary to me is when individuals don't believe there is any legislation that particularly would address a circumstance that they've encountered, they are less likely to report it. And so if they think that the police don't have powers and certainly that it won't be taken seriously, may not be prosecuted, may not be addressed ultimately if there's a conviction, then we find that people don't necessarily bring forward cases. And I think a really good analogy actually is in the space of domestic abuse, that where people think there isn't any specific response to a circumstance, and I'll give the example of coercive and controlling behaviour, they may be less likely to actually report the situation, but also it can be more difficult for the constabulary and for others to have a response to particular circumstances if we haven't actually considered that in our legislative framework.
What's your concern, Julian?
The sentencing bill, as far as I know, Jane, will there be a public consultation on this initial sentencing bill?
Most definitely. And Julian, you give me the opportunity as well to say that to do a full review of all of our sentencing is a huge, huge undertaking. So actually, I am mindful that there are aspects of the sentencing framework that we should be able to look to in the shorter to medium term, which we will try and progress. But the full review of all of our sentencing across the statute book is a much bigger undertaking. That will take us some time. I am keen to see that done in this administration, but we will have to sequence it. And there will be public consultation.
One of my concerns is the potential for a couple of things, the divisiveness, where you're giving, instead of an individual's responsibility, you're kind of grouping people. So you've got a whole group that can be sort of over and above the rights of other people, which could be seen as divisive. And then you've got the other side of this, where you could have people gaming the system, where they say that they've got a protected characteristic and will use the system to benefit themselves, if you see what I mean.
I absolutely agree that we don't want a situation that promotes divisiveness. On the other hand, we are an amazingly safe island, but I'm aware that for some individuals, sadly, they don't feel that same degree of safety as others because of protected characteristics. So I think it's got to be holistic, Julian. I think some of it is about education and awareness, and, you know, really helping people to understand how damaging it can be when there is attack or discrimination against people. I also think that in practice, for any individual case, of course it has to be evidentially led, and so it will be only in circumstances where there's clear evidence to attach what has happened to a particular protected characteristic.
Okay, all right, Julian, thanks for calling.
Thanks very much, Jane. Thanks very much, Andy.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Chris dropped a note in to say, could you ask Jane and Sam when and if they're bringing laws in for cruise ships in Isle of Man waters? There seem to be no restrictions on gambling or alcohol, and waste release laws seem to be a massive loophole. Is this something you've come across?
I have to say it's not something that has been raised to my attention, but you know, if there are concerns, then you know, I'm sure they can be looked at by the relevant department.
So Sam, would cruise ships be under Manx law when they're anchored 200 yards off the
So
Manx
in respect to the territorial waters, yeah. Yes. I mean, the only part that we could comment on, Andy, would be around liquor licensing. So we recently ran a consultation and made some changes in respect to the regulations around liquor licensing. And there is a specific one in there for sea transport, which is essentially shipping and cruise ships.
What are they allowed to do?
So in respect of not being able to sell alcohol to anyone not resident on the ship, if that makes sense. So there are different regulations that apply, for example, to the steam packets and to other Manx-based ships, but in respect of cruise ships, at the moment the regulations mean that they can't take on outside passengers and supply or sell alcohol.
Okay, we got a message now on the answer phone.
Hi, Andy. I'd love you to ask the Home Affairs Minister when they're going to change the law on death by dangerous driving. We were let down by the police, the Attorney General and the judge himself. When in the UK and the rest of the world, you cause somebody's death behind the wheel of a car, you will automatically serve a prison sentence. On the Isle of Man, it just seems that we allow young kids at 16 to drive cars, but there are no consequences when things go wrong and somebody dies. I think it's totally wrong. We should have a law in place to say that if you cause somebody's death, no matter whether you run over them or you're reckless, you should be prosecuted. You should be punished and sent to prison like they do everywhere else. But on the Isle of Man, it just seems that we give people a free ticket to do whatever they want to do. They can kill somebody behind the wheel of a car and they just walk away with it, not even a slap on the wrist, a driving ban. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, obviously, I edited the specific case that person was talking about, because we're not going to ever talk about specific cases. But what is the law on death, causing death by reckless driving?
So, I mean, first of all, Andy, I think I'd like to express my condolences for anyone who's experienced loss in the way described by the caller or similar. The legislation we have on driving and death that's caused, whether it's by dangerous or careless driving, is actually Department of infrastructure legislation. It's set out in our road traffic legislation. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the actual maxima for different offences, but I was checking it earlier this year, and I seem to recall that for one of our death by, I think it's careless driving, there is a maximum currently of 5 years, I believe, imprisonment and or a fine. Now, as I touched on a bit earlier for people who were listening, it is extremely difficult in practice in individual cases for me or indeed any politician to comment on why a particular sentence is or is not imposed, because in all the circumstances with all the evidence, that is a matter for the court. The only other thing I would say is, of course, it is for Timwell to set the framework around the sentencing. And we've touched on this review of sentencing that I said I would like to make sure is undertaken by the end of this administration. And to that end, I would like to ask and involve infrastructure in looking at the present framework so that we can be clear that the framework is where it should be in terms of the maximum sentences available to the judiciary. But actually, in every single case in practice, it will always be a matter for the court. And it is not something that me or any other politician really can interfere with those individual decisions.
Obviously, I mean, your whole department is never an impulse purchase for people. It's something that gets thrust on them, whether it's a fire, a rescue situation, a criminal situation, a criminality on them or committing it. So in terms of, just run that by me again, who decides what is reckless, dangerous, careless driving, due care and attention?
So that will be a matter for the evidence in the particular case as to what has led to the situation. It will also be a question in terms of prosecution. So based on the evidence, the police will investigate and there will be forensic evidence available that will determine what has happened and then whether or not that meets the criteria for reckless or dangerous driving. But also in a court case, it has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt as to the particular offence that took place. So there is work always with the prosecution as well to determine actually what is the evidence and what can be prosecuted to the required level.
And obviously, it's a horrible situation, but if someone has a family member who has died because of careless, dangerous, due care and attention driving, they don't make the distinction. They just know that their relatives died. So I'm just wondering what you could say to them about the process.
Yeah, and I think that is so difficult because how do you ever come up with a legislative response to that degree of loss and damage that that a family will feel? And I think, but it is also why we expect these things to be investigated properly and thoroughly. It's why I would expect our prosecution to give proper consideration to the right level of charge. And I would also expect that a full proper court case is undertaken with all of the evidence. And if there is any mitigation, then the defence would put that forward because there has to be a response. But in all the circumstances of any one case, I do understand that, you know, families and victims will sometimes feel that it wasn't the response they would have liked to have seen.
A man in line today is with Home Affairs Minister Jane Paul Wilson, Deputy Chief Exec is Sam McCauley, and Juan's with us. Hi, Juan, you're live with the Minister and the Deputy Chief Exec.
Hey, good afternoon, Andy. Good afternoon, Jane. Good afternoon, Sam.
Afternoon.
Going through law upon law upon law, we've got constitutional, criminal, contractual, corporate, statute, maritime, admiralty, which has a great impact on us somewhere down the line, and then we've got human rights, which is a law in itself. So just going on, I have a few points to make on different things, but following on from what Julian said before on the hate speech bill, and we know that once primary legislation is through, then secondary legislation slips through pretty easy. So I do have concerns, as Julian does, and I'm sure a lot of other people, on the rights on your freedom of speech, which is attached to the human rights. I think this bill could possibly be divisive and could possibly be dangerous. When, like I said, once primary legislation is through, secondary legislation slipped through, we could be in a situation where we have no man in line, because we've actually got a snowflake bill put through where everything will be a hate speech, because there's no definition of hate speech at the moment. And that's the dangerous part, is where we are now or where we would be in a year or 2 years' time, what the definition of hate speech is. We're in a very fast-changing woke world at the moment, and everyone's a snowflake on that side on the left. So it kind of concerns me of where that's going and our freedom of speech.
Okay, what were your other points, Ewan? If you just go through them, we'll take them one at a time.
Indeed, yeah. My other question would be the depth of the COVID report and the legalities of that. I take it that there's a KC going to be in charge of that. Who would actually be paying for that, and what depth is the COVID report going to go to? And the third question, which I'm going to ask every politician that comes on now and civil servant, because or chief executive, because I think it's coming to be a very important topic. What is your alignment and agendas of the going with the World Economic Forum and their agendas? I'd like to know from our politicians and chief executives what their alignment is, and do they agree with their policies?
Okay, all right. Jane Paul Wilson.
So, yes, Ewan, you've touched on the hate crime legislation. I mean, as I was talking about before, My concern here is, in the same way that we have jurisdictions that have got the ability to recognise the extreme harm that can happen to certain people because of their protected characteristics, and indeed we have seen violence and harm to individuals on the Isle of Man, just to ensure that our legislative framework has an appropriate response to that. So, I mean, I completely understand, as I did before, this is absolutely not about promoting a divisiveness. It certainly isn't about saying that people don't have freedom of expression anymore. Indeed, I think, Ewan, you referenced human rights, and there is enshrined in our human rights legislation that understanding of freedom of association, freedom of expression. In all things, there is a balance. I think for some individuals on this island, and thankfully, as far as I'm aware from what's reported, and I'm not sure that everything is reported, but from what's reported, we don't see a huge amount of it. But given the level of harm in individual cases, it's a question really of making sure our legislative framework has an appropriate response.
I think one of the points is also the fact that that may be the end of the nexus. If you take hate speech, offence is often taken when it hasn't been given. So and I'm not being facetious, but you know, if somebody said there's a boat in the morning to one person, they'd laugh it off. Someone else may take offence at that.
And Andy, I think it's a really good point. There is always a gap between intent and impact, but I think as a society it helps us all, because most people don't intend to cause offence, actually. They're expressing a view, they're expressing their thoughts. I think when we consider impact, though, I think if people thought, well, actually, that wasn't my intent to cause that impact, I'm, you know, still want to have an open and thoughtful debate about many things, I'll try and do it in a way that promotes good understanding and good debate, as opposed to having an impact that I didn't intend in the first place.
Okay, and the COVID report.
So the COVID report, yes, Ewan's right. We have appointed Kate Brunner, KC, as the independent chair to lead that review. It is going to be paid for out of taxpayer funds. It is a matter that the Public Accounts Committee brought forward, and Tynwald has mandated should take place. It's an independent review, and therefore it has far more flexibility than a formal statutory public inquiry in terms of how the evidence can be taken, which will enable the independent chair to do a variety of things. I expect will make a public call for evidence. I think she'll probably also try and do some focus groups with different people. And if you look at the terms of reference, you'll see the range of areas that have been set out that ought to be considered. Everything from the response in education to the financial assistance schemes, to returning residents. There are quite a few aspects that are on the list. So I hope that helps Ewan with some of the understanding. And those terms of reference have been published as well, so anybody can have a look at those.
Okay. And in terms of the global elite, the World Economic Forum, are you a fully paid up member?
Goodness, that's a very wide open question, isn't it? I mean, I think, you know, the Isle of Man, in terms of playing its part as a responsible jurisdiction in terms of our international relations. I think we have to be mindful of a range of international bodies and what they are promoting and why. Certainly in terms of our international dealings, you know, we have to be aware of moves with whether it's about taxation or other matters that affect our global relations, and have to be cognizant of those in the way we develop our own policy.
Okay, where do you stand on the World Economic Forum, Juan?
Well, that was a very good answer, Jane, but a good typical politician's answer or a lawyer's answer. What I actually asked you was, were you aligned to what was happening and the agendas of the World Economic Forum? So it was a nice little chess move, but I asked you directly.
Okay, when you say the agenda of the World Economic Forum specifically, what are you talking about, Juan?
We have a body of unelected people now, a very wealthy elite people, and the people who are actually switched on and actually read news rather than Emmerdale Farm, and you'll see what's happening in the world and how this is getting manipulated, especially with the likes of the G20, the proposal now for digital vaccination passports, etc. There's very, very strong moves now. Maybe a year ago, people would laugh this off as conspiratorial. It's not conspiratorial anymore. This is out there, and these people are out there making these statements. And where they're going to get power, these unelected people, is that elected people are going to bow down to what they are saying. And that's my concern here, is with laws and with people and politicians and civil servants, chief executives who are in power, who have got this agenda. It okay. really does concern me where we are going with this if people have got no backbone.
Okay, all right, we appreciate that, Juan. Thanks for calling today. More calls to get to and lots more to get through. Cracky, we're over halfway through. It's 27 minutes before one, and we're live with Sam McCauley, Deputy Chief Exec, and Jane Paul Wilson, the Minister for Justice and Home Affairs.
Concerned, confused or curious about climate change? Want to do your part? Then visit netzeromatrix.com, helping businesses and individuals understand the net zero targets that government has set, how they'll be achieved, and what impact it will have upon us. Plus, get practical advice and tips for saving energy, the options available for switching to renewable energy technologies, and much more. We all need to do what we can. So visit netzeromatrix.com and join us.
Red and yellow and pink or blue?
Thinking of a rainbow?
No, choosing colours for our windows and doors at Manx Glass and Glazing.
Oh, who'd have thought we'd have so much choice?
We do at Manx Glass and Glazing. When it comes to windows and doors, they offer a great choice of styles, materials and fabulous contemporary colours.
Improve and brighten up your home. Visit the Manx Glass and Glazing showroom on Snugborough Trading Estate, or get inspired when you see the range at manxglass.com.
Visit Just Care Products right behind B&Q and see our wide range of mobility aids, from small everyday items to rise recline chairs, beds, scooters and our airline-friendly foldable power chair. Plus, we are the island's only stockists of cozy feet footwear. Just Care Products, right behind B&Q.
Just Care Products, 627-177.
Bored with turkey and all the trimmings at every Christmas party? This year, spice things up at the Ocean Views. Our fabulous Christmas menus give you a traditional festive feast with a difference, and a unique Mexican steakhouse vibe that's perfect whether it's one person or 120. With new dance floor, booth seating, plus wheelchair access and facilities, visit oceanviews.im or call 623348 and spice it up this Christmas at the Ocean Views Onken.
Tucked away in the Tynwald business is an apparently modest and unassuming item which seeks to allow for greater access to the Isle of Man's beneficial ownership register, and yet this is a significant step in removing the secrecy jurisdiction label through which the Isle of Man's international reputation has been attacked for several decades. Treasury Minister Alex Allenson and longtime critic of the Isle of Man's financial secrecy, Phil Crane, join me, Phil Gorn, on Agenda at 6 p.m. this evening on Manx Radio to discuss this weighty topic. The Minister also discusses the impact of the UK financial statement on the Manx economy.
The Man in Line, brought to you by netzeromatrix.com, the Isle of Man's main net zero progress website.
24 minutes now before one on Manx Radio, talking home affairs today. Mark, hi, you're live with the Minister and the Deputy Chief Exec.
Hi, Andy, how you doing, fella?
Good, thanks.
Good, I'm Jane. Sam, nice to hear you.
Thank you, Mark.
You too, Mark.
Right. I've got a couple of issues I'd just like to bring forward. Anybody that knows me knows that I've been a long time critic of the police. I think that some of them do a fantastic job, whereas some of them, shall we say, are just glorified traffic wardens, in my opinion. But I'd like to bring up two little cases that happened recently to me and see what your thoughts might be on them. The first one was about a month and a half ago. Somebody decided, you know, some waste of oxygen decided to vandalise my car. So I phoned the police up about it, and I spoke to somebody, a police officer, and he said to me, do you have CCTV? I said, no. Does your neighbours have CCTV? I said, no. Do you have dash cam? I said, no. And he said, well, there's not really a lot we can do about it then. He said, I'll give you an order number, a quota number for the crime that was being committed. And that was basically the end of the matter. A week later, I got a phone call from a police woman saying, did I still want to treat it as a crime? And I thought, 7 days have gone by and that's it. One phone call. You couldn't even be bothered to come round and have a look at it. And the second one was, can somebody, Sam might be the best one to answer this question, tell me exactly what the point of the 631212 number is. I have a disabled parking space outside my house, and I have had trouble recently with workmen parking their vans on it, so I can't park my car. And the other day I rang 631212 seven times. Nobody answered it, and eventually it was bumped through to 999. And I spoke to this lovely girl at the emergency services of the 999, and she basically said to me, yeah, that's what happens if nobody answers 631212, it bumps through to them. It's not an emergency. What is the point in the reception area at the police station if it's not manned? You ring 631. You hear on Manx Radio every single day, the police are asking for this, the police are asking for that. Ring 631212. But when you ring it, nobody answers it.
Okay, Sam?
Okay. I mean, obviously from that side, it's fantastic to hear that feedback. And obviously it's one that we can talk to the constabulary around. It is difficult every time to have manned phones. And that is the backup, is that it goes through. Because again, just as a point of communication or someone needing to get in touch with the police, the emergency services joint control room will always step in at that point in case there is a genuine emergency and try to deal with it as quickly as possible. But we can take on board that feedback and obviously pass it on to the police. But I think it is that difficulty of always having somebody available to speak to you. In terms of vandalism, again, I know the minister's talked about this in respect of other calls around the, you know, operational matters for the constabulary, but obviously they do get in contact with people regarding circumstances like that, which may not be investigated in other jurisdictions, but obviously are ones where if they can find evidence to be able to take something forward, that is obviously what they're seeking in terms of the discussions with you.
Yeah, Mark, I think Sam's right. I mean, very happy to feed these things back to the constabulary. I think I hear your views about the constabulary. My own sense is that the constabulary achieve an incredible amount here for the size that we have and the range of issues that we have to tackle, from the sorts of things that quite rightly you're concerned about, vandalism and people parking, which, you know, again, I would make this plea on the programme actually while we're on, Andy, that please, people really do need to be sensitive and thoughtful around things like disabled parking spaces. They are marked for a reason. It is not considerate or appropriate for people to abuse those services.
So, if I have any agenda, Jane Paul Wilson, it is people who park in disabled parking spaces. A disabled parking space is either a disabled parking space or it's not. Mm. So why don't we have a prohibitive fine for disabled parking spaces, and people would stop once and for all? If it were £1,000 fine, after the first five, people wouldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, it comes back to it's a real shame that we have to get to levels of enforcement around these things, whereas actually what we really want is a society that considers
policing by consent.
Policing by consent, and that considers why those spaces are there and doesn't abuse availability for people who genuinely need them. Mm. So I'm glad it's your campaign and it's helpful to have this discussion. So thanks for raising it, Mark. And I think, yes, we can feed these things back. It can be difficult. There's no question. question that sometimes with stretched resource, with how officers have to be deployed, it is not always easy, as Sam has alluded to have everything that you would like all of the time. I think the other thing is the department in its policing plan for the forthcoming year recognises that there are a number of very, very serious matters we expect the police to deal with, everything from serious and organised crime to exploitation of vulnerable and young people, to economic crime. But also we recognise that lower level vandalism, antisocial behaviour is damaging to people and communities. And so we don't want to lose sight of that. And I think our force is one of the very few forces across the British Isles that still has a focus on neighbourhood policing and will try and respond to every incident that is raised.
Mark, are the workmen still parking in your space?
Not at the moment, they're not, because it's raining and they don't want to get out of the vans. But just one final thing. I was on a few months ago, I believe it was Jane I spoke to then, about boy racers and stuff like that around where I live. Can somebody tell me, Jane's just mentioned it there, neighbourhood policing. There is no such thing as neighbourhood policing on this island. I haven't seen a policeman up where I live for donkey's years.
Whereabouts is that, Mark?
I live in Williston. And I remember talking to you about it, Andy. You said that when you were a youngster and I was a youngster, you couldn't walk anywhere without seeing a bobby. And you got to know them, and they got to know you. Nowadays, it's almost like they're frightened to get out of a van or frightened to get out of a car in case they get wet or it's too cold for them. Why do they have to go everywhere in a vehicle? Can they not walk?
This goes back, Jane Paul Wilson, to obviously, I mean, once upon a time, Williston had a police station with a police house. And obviously, whatever the reasons were, whether they were pecuniary or policy decisions, the Paul Rose police station went, all the police, local police stations went. And this whole point about people not seeing police officers.
Yeah, I mean, Mark, I have to say, I personally do see police officers, but perhaps we're not always in the place where they are. And it goes back to having to do an awful lot with a resource that's really stretched. So we have around 230 police officers. And if you think of the full range of matters that they deal with, it is truly breathtaking, actually. The Chief Constable's report this year did point out that we remain the safest place in the British Isles. So I completely accept that in an ideal world, there would be someone available at the immediate point for every matter that people want to raise. It is a challenge to be able to do that.
And a couple of bobbies out on the beat is going to save an absolute fortune in petrol money for the Home Affairs Department. If you're sending two bobbies out just to walk around Williston, walk around Douglas, walk around, it's costing nothing apart from the shoe wear. Whereas if they're driving from A to B, it's costing a small fortune in car, petrol, tyres and what have you. And the overall, it just paints a very, very bad picture that somebody's walking down the street and they see a police car going past with one of them drinking a cup of coffee.
And I think, Mark, you know, it's a combination, isn't it? I mean, there are times when it's right to be able to respond in a vehicle to cover the range of matters that the police may be called to. And it's also right that the police patrol on foot. And indeed, I know they do. I think what is difficult is to try and respond to everything. And I can give you a good example from the recent Chief Constable's awards ceremony, where, you know, there was an incident because of an individual in crisis where the local neighbourhood police, who would be on foot patrolling in the south one Saturday evening, actually spent a period of time with an individual in crisis because that was the immediate need and harm. So it is difficult, and I think finding perfection is probably not going to be possible, but I think, you know, we have to recognize the range of demands on our police service, and we will very happily feed back the particular points that you've made today.
Okay, well, all right.
Jane, thank you very much. You're a very erudite lady. And Andy, thank you for letting me be on.
No, not at all. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
indeed.
Mark.
Okay, good to hear from you. And we've got John on Man in Line today. Hi, John. You're with the Home Affairs Minister and Deputy Chief Exec.
Oh, hi, Andy. Hi, Minister for Justice.
Yes, good Home afternoon.
Affairs. Good
afternoon.
Good afternoon. No, I'll come straight to the point. Minister, have we still got the Youth Justice Team in force?
No, we don't, John. I don't know whether you've been following, though, that the Department of Home Affairs in its delivery plan actually has a focus on working up early intervention and support for young people. And in fact, I don't want to preempt a forthcoming Timwell debate on this, but the Constitutional, Legal Affairs and Justice Committee has done an inquiry over the last years, which we were delighted to participate in. And some recommendations are coming forward or have been published by that committee. Things that, without sort of preempting our response, that we are very, very mindful of and keen to progress. So
okay.
my view is we do need that back.
What's your question, John?
Two questions. The Youth Justice Team did an absolute fantastic, sterling job. And as to why they were dismembered, I don't know. But I'll give you an example of what's happening now in the Isle of Man, Minister. We have an unlimited amount of young children being convicted again and again in the courts for taking drugs. These young children that are being convicted, they're not actually aware of the fact when the police speak to them. But it'll be on their licence. I think the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act would stipulate they have to put it on an application form for a job, possibly for a two-year period. That, I would think, would stop them getting any half-decent job. I know that, you know that. We can't keep convicting these young children all the time for smoking cannabis. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Send them to a classroom session. Explain the dangers of drugs, what they do to their personal life, their family life. And then, if they're convicted the second time, go up the path of taking them to court. You see, I do think, generally, the Youth Justice Team could have stopped a lot of this at the beginning to intercept the children who were, for want of a better word, going off the rails. But it's no longer there. There goes, for the grace of God, my children and your children. I think we should educate them, not prosecute them.
I think you make some really, really good points, John. I fully agree with you that most of this is about education and awareness and helping young people understand some of the risks and dangers that they face. To your point about the Youth Justice Team, I know that the work done by that team several years ago was really, really good and had success. And so that is why we are looking to restore and bring back the Youth Justice Team. I think the other thing is that when it comes to intervention, in the meanwhile, the Police Early Action Team has been doing a huge amount of work. So the idea there is, as you rightly say, when young people come to the attention of the police, the first aim is to try and intervene and divert them. And I think the figure was something like over 90% of those one-off referrals resulted in a successful diversion. So that work is there, but I think we can do more, and it is the department's intention to restore the Youth Justice Team and to look at, you know, how do we best intervene to divert and support young people, particularly those vulnerable young people who are perhaps more at risk than any others to becoming involved in crime and having awful damage to their lives.
Okay. All right, John, thanks for calling today.
Yep. Bye now.
Appreciate that. It's 11 minutes before one on Man in Line.
The football's kicking off at all hours. Eating sure to go into extra time. And drinking, using all the reserves. So get your home game together now at ShopRite. Fresh, frozen, and a massive choice of ready meals for less prep time. More screen time. Having friends round for the match? We've snacks and party food galore. And all your favourite wine and beers. Price match to knock others out of the park. We're close to where you are. ShopRite. Proudly locally owned.
Inhale and exhale. Remember to breathe.
Breathe? It's too hot in here to breathe. Since when did Vori start teaching hot yoga?
Since you got such a good deal on double glazing, of course.
Conestar Bank, creating a cleaner future for the island. With green finance to help your business reach its sustainability goals more affordably.
OMG, even my knees are sweating.
Visit conestarbank.co.im/green to find out more. All loans are subject to status. Terms, conditions and early settlement fees apply.
When you need a fitting memorial or headstone for a loved one, contact Manx Memorials in Peel. This long-standing family-run Manx company offer a wide range of granite and marble headstones and memorials, along with an island-wide inscription and renovation service. Manx Memorial's skilled professionals will take the time to help you choose a suitable memorial, and we're proud to say we'll beat other local quotes. Call 843 861 or email matthew@manxmemorials.co.uk.
Do you have a passion and understanding of the role of public service media in our community? Are you well versed in the main issues and challenges facing broadcasters today? Do you have a clear understanding of the needs of the Isle of Man audience? We are seeking to appoint an additional trustee to sit on the new Manx Radio Board of Trustees together with the existing non-executive directors of the company. The candidate appointed is likely to have experience, skills, and expertise that is relevant to the activities carried out by Manx Radio. If you would like to explore this opportunity further, please head to the Manx Radio website, click on About Us, and then click on Vacancies. Good luck.
The Man in Line, brought to you by NetZeroMatrix.com, your one-stop shop for advice on renewable energy solutions and other green initiatives.
Live today with Jane Paul Wilson, the Minister, and Sam McCauley, the Deputy Chief Exec of Home Affairs. You're looking for volunteers for to be an appropriate adult. Sam, what's that about?
So, Andy, it's not actually us. It's the Department of Health and Social Care who are looking for volunteers. But, you know, we've focused a lot from callers today on kind of the work of the constabulary and otherwise. And this is actually a voluntary scheme, which is hugely important for the constabulary, but has to be independent of them, which is why DHSC is leading the call for volunteers. And these volunteers actually support and act as appropriate adults. So that's for young people and for vulnerable adults, including those who have mental health issues or learning difficulties. And they support those vulnerable children and adults through both the police and the courts process. So it's a really vital role, and we just wanted to put out that obviously DHSC are looking for volunteers there, and we're hopeful that people will put themselves forward.
Okay, this is for young people aged between 10 and 17, vulnerable adults, including those with mental health issues and learning difficulties. And what will it actually involve the volunteers doing? How much time do they have to give up?
So it's a complete mix, really, but you do get called on out of hours because obviously those volunteers step in and assist when a vulnerable young person or adult has been arrested and they don't have a parent, guardian or support worker to help safeguard them and their rights as well. So again, it's, you know, you can commit as much time or as little time as you want, but it is a kind of out of hours call because obviously that can take place at any time.
Okay, now if you want more information, Scott Wilson is the person, the DHSC, and telephone number is 685 816. It's a voluntary position, 685 816, Scott Wilson at the DHSC. A note in from Pat, who says the Rehabilitation of Criminals Act. No protection if a person wants to travel to a lot of countries like Australia, New Zealand and America. In these countries, you have to give life details of any conviction. Is that true? That's from Pat.
Well, I think there are obviously rules in other countries that even though we can put in provisions in our own laws that say, you know, after a period of time, a conviction is spent and no longer has to be disclosed. Although for certain convictions, that's not even true here. So depending on the type of job you want to go for and the nature of the conviction, you might still be asked to disclose that information, particularly if you were going to work with children or vulnerable adults, for example. But what we don't have control over is the laws that are put in place by other countries, which can be difficult. And I think it goes back to John's point that sometimes, you know, our young people need to understand that certain convictions can follow them for the rest of their lives in some respects.
With lots of messages in about causing injuries and death by dangerous driving, but we've done that. Possibly we may come back to that in the future. Just one thing now. The parallel I'm going to draw is the Sulby Dam, is the Sulby Reservoir and the Sulby Valley. And the Sulby Reservoir represents the amount of drugs on Merseyside, and we are the Sulby Valley. And in the middle is the dam, which is the police force and DHA. And the new chief exec, the new chief constable, said he wants to create a hostile environment for those Merseyside drugs gangs.
Yeah, and I think that's right. We are fully aware the present chief constable has put in an awful lot of work working with Merseyside, recognising that we are the end of the line, that we are vulnerable to County Line's operations, and that, you know, the drugs dealers in Merseyside, serious and organised crime, they are ruthless, and we are a lucrative market. So I think it is absolutely right that we retain a focus on that.
I mean, in broad terms, drugs are worth twice here what they are in Merseyside. And these people are ruthless, inhuman, savages. They don't care less. They couldn't care less about ruining people's lives on the Isle of Man. And our young people are in danger.
And you're absolutely right. And I was really, really pleased that last week at Castle Rushen High School, in fact, there was the first theatre and education project to try and raise our young people's awareness of how they can be exploited. Because it is it's effectively grooming in some respects, that they are befriended by people who offer them, apparently, you know, the sort of thing things that they might want and seek, particularly at a difficult time at the moment with cost of living. And we have to help our young people and their parents and guardians and carers understand how these ruthless people will operate to try and lure them in. But they're not the friends of young people. They are part of a lucrative illegal business.
Sam?
Thanks, Andy. And also, just to add to that, obviously, I think the Minister's touched on it previously, the policing plan that the department sets out really clearly that one of the strategic objectives, which obviously is mirrored in the Chief Constable's report, is around serious and organised crime and stopping that drug trade.
Well, we've got through roughly about 10% of what I had on the list, but thanks for being with us. Thank you, Sam. Good to talk to you today. Okay, and Jane Paul Wilson. Well, I wish everybody in DHA a very Merry Christmas.
And the same to you, Andy.
And hopefully see you in the new year. Thanks for being with us
today.
This coming Wednesday, Claire Barber, the DEFA Minister, will be on Man in Line. And a week on Friday, Daphne Kane will be in the MHA talking about the Climate Change Transformation Board and lots more. In the meantime, we're back to an open line tomorrow, 66 13 68, email, text, WhatsApp. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Christie's next with 1 to 3.